702 on 92.7 and 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 EMEA Finance African Banking Awards for the Best Investment Bank. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Across the show today, we'll of course unpack quite a few issues. It is the last day, of course, of the investment conference. So we'll chat to Trudy Makaya, the economic advisor to President Cyril Ramaphosa, about just exactly where that money is going to go to and just what are the conditions of all the money we've received. 371 billion rand is no small feat, of course, but the work has been done over the years. So we'll get to chat about exactly what happened then, where that comes from. Graham Kerner does join us for that market commentary. And it seems that the property market is beginning to stabilize, having been what we're calling a buyer's market. But how much of a buyer's market is it? We chat to the CEO of PAM Golding Properties, Andrew Golding, just before we head into the poultry segment. And we just get to chat about how we can get more jobs, increase production, and perhaps help South Africa's chicken industry. The CEO of the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters gets to chat to us as well just before 7 o'clock. Capitec seems to be struggling quite a bit now, and it's going to hurt a lot. It seems that Capitec is filing for an application for leave to appeal a judgment which has ordered it to consent to a Gupta-linked company selling its shares in the bank in order to pay back losses that it suffered by a Transnet pension fund. What does that mean? Well, I'll get to chat all about it a little bit later on with Kieran Ryan, who will get to chat to us. Of course, on Thursdays, we get to have that personal finance feature. Warren Ingram will join us in studio. Pablo Fatidis also will get in on that small business focus, 7 steps to building an asset of value and why it's critical that you do. It's 18:09. Welcome to it. This is the Thursday edition of The Money Show. My name is Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield.
Connect. Engage. Change. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
So as we continue to try and get more investment into South Africa, one of the things that has certainly been of question is just how much of it can we garner as South Africa looks to be headed towards non-investment grade, if Moody's has anything to do with it. S&P yesterday even said that we have a great risk of being downgraded as well, even further. We saw the likes of Eskom being downgraded to six notches below investment grade as well. Things aren't looking good for South Africa's economy, but you can tell that the investment giants that President Cyril Ramaphosa has put out there have certainly done the hard graft and the hard work. And here we are now to perhaps getting $371 billion worth of investments. Let's chat to the person who's kind of been responsible and has taken this challenge head on and wanted to ensure that South Africa gets as much as possible. Trudy Makaya, economic advisor to President Cyril Ramaphosa. Trudy, thank you so much for the time this evening. It hasn't been an easy task, and I'm sure the work must have started from last year already just to get to this point.
Good evening, Arabile, and good evening to your listeners. You're right, it hasn't been easy. It started last year when we held the first investment conference. We got significant pledges in that conference, and one of the key things we had to do was to make sure that we constantly engage with those companies to help them and understand if they're facing any challenges in realizing that investment. Then, of course, the second order of business was to encourage new investments to be announced at this year's investment conference. So if we reflect back, you know, over the past year, under 230 of the 300, just under 240 actually, 240 billion of the 300 billion rand that was pledged last year is in implementation. You know, at different stages of implementation, some have broken ground and factories have been built. You'd have seen the president go and do some openings at a few of those establishments. And then there's a small proportion where, you know, there's significant challenge, either regulatory matters that we would work with the business to resolve, or perhaps the business itself, you know, kind of didn't quite make the right call.
Sure.
And the investment is happening slower than expected. But on aggregate, we're seeing that most of the pledges that were made are going ahead. So that's been very encouraging.
Yeah. How difficult a task, though, was it, Trudy, if you don't mind me asking, to convince people in a time when South Africa just does look to still be headed lower, though? Things aren't necessarily getting too much better when it comes to our economic discourse. You've seen the MTBPS itself, and that hasn't painted a good picture. But to continue to say to people, we are still the right investment place to kind of put your money in.
So I think this is why investment by both domestic and international investors is so important. You know, you have business cycles, you have challenges, and we see it in our financial market. You know, our currency has been under a lot of pressure. Our bond yields have certainly gone up in the past few years, where we've been downgraded. And those portfolio investors who invest just to buy shares today, sell them tomorrow, or those who hold our debt, valuable as they are, they have quick mobility. They can easily get money out of the country. But you have to remember that there are certain enduring advantages that South Africa has that make it a good place to host productive investments. So if you think about our mineral resources, for instance, which some of them are very relevant for powering the green economy. If you look at platinum, manganese, you know, getting investors to capitalize on those opportunities is a long-term game. It's not that, you know, you get a downgrade tomorrow and somebody shuts down a mine. Similarly, you know, you've seen smartphone manufacturing. This year, there were also many manufacturing pledges that came forth. A lot of them looking at the long-term potential of the African market, the continental integration that we're about to embark on,
yeah,
the fact that we are a youthful population. So those things don't change overnight just because you're having challenges.
Sure.
Our responsibility is to make sure that those challenges that we do face don't overwhelm, and then we are unable to capitalize on what we have.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we've been saying. There's a medium-term and a long-term story that appeals to people who are making direct and fixed investments that we're going to keep emphasizing.
Yeah. So none of this is purely conditional then on, you know, depending on where South Africa's economic trajectory goes over the perhaps the next 3 or 5 years, depending on their commitment to the country.
Well, it's not that it's completely unconditional. I suppose I'm saying that it's not that it follows, you know, the day-to-day, week-to-week events. But of course, in terms of policy certainty, it helps us that, you know, the mining charter discussions have progressed. It's helped that we do have an IRP in place, that, you know, the spectrum information memorandum is out, and we have to keep, you know, at that. And of course, for those of the slower projects, you know, we also have to reflect on why those are going slowly, and often it would be those kinds of policy and regulatory challenges. So it's not that it's completely unconditional. It depends on the overall business environment, which is why it's also been so important that we keep working at our target of improving the ease of doing business. Being seen as an economy in the top 50 will also help perceptions, but also mean that the experience of investors is so much better. So those things matter, and for us to keep the momentum that we have, and for us for the new investments to be realized, we also have to keep looking at that side of the equation.
Sure. How much of this, of these new pledges, though, are perhaps replenishments? Is all of that 371 billion, yes, we know the 8 billion is still conditional then, how much of this is full on new investments and nothing from last year? It's brand new projects, or is this just an additional? Are there replenishments to this? What exactly is the breakdown of it, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't mind at all. So I think as a principle, it's important first that we agree or we appreciate that, you know, if it's a new project, there's a phase one that's announced last year, a phase two that's announced this year. That's important capital. That is, you know, entrenching and, you know, expanding a project, and that should be seen as important because it does create jobs, it does create economic activity. We're still crunching the numbers in terms of, you know, what is brownfield and what is greenfield. You know, we've been careful not to include, as I said, purely financial transactions. What we're seeing is that this year we have a greater proportion of smaller, so a greater number of announcements, but small size per announcement. And a lot of that would have been small. But for me to say right now exactly this much is purely greenfield is difficult. Suffice to say that we're seeing lots of new, smaller, dynamic investors coming into play, and not so much those mega investments, which in some cases have just been, I shouldn't say just, had been expansions, which are also important from a job creation perspective.
Yeah. Trudy, what do you say to the naysayers, though, those that have certainly come about and asked the question as to whether this really serves South Africa any purpose? If there's anything that they can physically, tangibly see for South Africa, whether this is an investment conference that is just another talk shop, is just another way of spinning the narrative and trying to look positive. What do you say to those kinds of people as well in a time when, of course, yes, South Africa needs it the most, but action certainly speaks louder than words?
Sure, that's very important. But I mean, if you look at it just in terms of how important perceptions and confidence are, if you look at our FDI statistics, maybe, for the year 2018, there was a fourfold increase in FDI relative to 2017. Some of it has to do with just the lumpy nature of investment, but I mean, four times is significant. So we are seeing some of it in the figures that it's headed in the right direction. Overall, you know, we still do see that investment as a percentage of GDP is nowhere near the target that we would like it to be in terms of the NDP target. And so we will keep working towards that. It's not to say that suddenly with these pledges we've reached that goal, but in terms of the direction of change, that increase in FDI, the fact that, there was significant weakness in gross capital formation, but that has been arrested. Yeah. I think that's important to show that progress is being made, and slowly it's filtering in the numbers. We're also going to do a much better job of communicating the jobs impact. You'd have seen it, as the president talked about the projected 400,000 jobs, and we will give feedback on how that's panning out. Because ultimately, I think that's what would demonstrate that this makes a difference in people's lives.
It is definitely what matters most. Trudy, is this going to be an annual event? I mean, we did have, as you said, phase one last year, phase two sort of this year. You planning on having this again next year, continuing to try and woo investors yearly?
I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. I mean, I think there will possibly come a time where the commitment, will vary in terms of size.
Sure.
But even if, the criticism would be that if you do it too often, you lose momentum.
That was going to be my thought, yeah.
Getting feedback, looking back, giving an update on project, whatever the number of that particular year is, I think that's also an important ongoing process. So there is some value in having it annually. I think the president would probably want to have it annually, but that would be communicated in due course.
Trudy, certainly a tough task ahead in trying to not only navigate the economic turmoil South Africa currently does face, but certainly in trying to ensure that investors internationally continue to pour in beyond just the investment conference and not just wait for this annual event every year, but certainly to pique their interest every year and try to make sure that South Africa does garner the kind of interest that it probably should as Africa's most industrialized economy. Economic advisor to President Cyril Ramaphosa, Trudy Makaya, thank you so much for your time this evening. A really great chatting to you.
Thank you.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Well, the market didn't necessarily go higher today, but there was quite a bit of company news as well. So we'll get straight into it. Graham Kerner from Kerner Perspective joins us then as we get into this market picture. A general sense of negativity today, but it's a slight pause considering the state of affairs when it comes to the U.S.-China trade negotiation. They were fearful that perhaps they may not have a venue to sign off this trade deal. And that was... Really, that was that's all code. That was stifling it, right?
Yeah, right. But there's a lot of psychology and gamesmanship going on here. Yeah. And I think the Chinese, frankly, have actually got the upper hand right now. I don't think Donald Trump wants to raise those tariffs on consumer goods on the 15th of December.
Yeah.
I think there's a growing sense that the tariff war or trade war is likely to affect the US more over the next while. It's already hurt the Chinese economy. Yeah. So, yeah.
And they're finding ways to prop things up, right? They're actually going to try and stimulate their economy, but look, still growing
6%.
Plus minus 6-odd%. And I mean, yes, fine. Those are 30-year lows for them, if not more. But, you know, ultimately, they're not necessarily going to cry a little bit anymore because they are trying to prop up that economy quite heavily right now. What levers is the question does Donald Trump have?
Well, I think he's probably thinks he's got moral suasion over the Fed, but Powell and others don't agree with that. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, a lot about the fact that under him, you know, unemployment is at a record level. And I'll challenge them. Go and look at the unemployment rates when Barack Obama handed over. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. We've moved from maybe 3.8% unemployment to 3% or closer to 3%. But the heavy lifting, frankly, was done before. So, but he'll claim the credit.
The economy is working itself now, right?
But I think the important point when we say today our market was down by, let's call it about 0.33%. Arabella, what's really important, this market, the JSE, is up 7% if you take a one-month view. You look across at Europe, similar numbers, maybe even a little bit more than that. Sure. So the market has actually had quite a good run. And let's remember, the Rand has gone from 1525, 1530 to 1470. That was a little bit of a deflator. Earlier this morning, there were rumors that the Chinese, you know, the venue thing, we're sort of saying, well, we're not sure we want to play ball, but that luckily was a non-event, but a hell of a lot on the results front today.
Trusting the Frescini Group? I mean, their share price didn't necessarily do too badly today either.
No. Look, I mean, if you look at what some of the retailers have delivered, and I think it's been a noisy period. You've got pick and pay, low base effects, ShopRite, lots of once-offs and hyperinflation. You saw a similar pain on somebody like PPC today. I like the story. I think Frescini Group has gone about the international strategy better than most. You saw Truworths also releasing today. You look at sales up, call it 2% versus 6%. When you get down to headline earnings per share, it was a little bit more tepid for Frescini Group. But I think it's a good portfolio. It's well-placed, doing well in a really lousy environment. Let's just think how a company like Massmart, which is obviously not in clothing, how difficult the last few years have been for them. So I think Frescini Group coming off today, maybe in line with people saying, you know, we want to put some money on some of those that haven't performed. But if you look at Dischem today, I thought pretty ordinary results, even when you strip out the once-offs.
Have they flattened out? And I say that because, you know, they went on a massive drive to get all these pharmacies up and running everywhere as well, much the same as Clicks. But have they pretty much flattened out, would you say, and has perhaps Clicks dug a lot more into their business model?
I think both of them have taken market share from the independents, and I think the big retailers, frankly, didn't understand this model and credit. Clicks and Dischem have done a fantastic job. And I think for both of them, there is still store rollout. But as you move forward, you know, with that big footprint, particularly Clicks, it becomes increasingly difficult to actually move the needle.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, there were lots of one-offs. But even when you got down to an adjusted operating level, from what I can remember, the number was slightly negative for Dischem. So, you know, 28 multiple for a company is not really moving the earnings needle. Just feels a little bit much. And obviously, late last week with the trading update, the market was spooked. And then today, I think people maybe went through the numbers.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a stock that's loved by a lot of people. There are people like myself who's maybe like the story, but sort of feel that there's just too much good news priced in, and there's runway, but that runway gets shorter and shorter with every year that passes. So, I think in the context, a company like Frescini, that's just sort of, or TFG as I want to now be known, is just, you know, got a good brand portfolio and are doing good things.
Mm. Very lastly, MultiChoice Group, their share price went up, what's it, three quarters of a percent, should I say, by close of trade then. Still looking fairly good after, what was it, their split off then from Naspers.
Yeah, so I think this is, you know, a lot of people would say, well, this is a fantastic story. And, you know, critics like myself will always say, well, you know, we want to buy things that are delivering better earnings growth than the PE multiple. The PEG ratio is right. You know, you're growing your profits at 20-25%, and your PE is only 14-15. It looks compelling. The problem I've got is their world is changing rapidly.
Mm.
You've got the giants, the Disneys of this world, the Netflix, the Amazons of this world, developing content wanting to hold that content. It's going to become increasingly difficult, I believe, for MultiChoice. So great result. you know, all credit, but this, I think, is the tail end of the pay TV market.
It's going to be difficult then to sustain this business model as well headed forward. So we'll see how things go from there. Unfortunately, Graham, that is all the time we do have this evening. Graham Koerner from Koerner Perspective joining us as we unpack that market. It is
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you relevant market insights through the Africa Financial Markets Index Report. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
All right, so it's 18:41 as we get back into our news stories, of course. Quite a lot still happening, and we will get to unpack just the Capitec situation and that saga as the they want to appeal the ruling on selling shares in their company in order to settle state capture losses. So clearly the state capture saga has now landed on their feet, and they certainly now need to try and clean it up somewhat. But for now, though, let's get into the property segment. Pam Golding Properties, well, their annual residential property report shows that there may even have been signs of the residential property market beginning to stabilize, prices, of course, beginning to drop in an economy that has suffered quite a lot of headwinds. South Africa certainly struggling across the board. Let's chat now to Paul Matthews, or rather, should I say, sorry, I was actually not Paul Matthews on that one. And we'll get to chat to Andrew Golding, should I say, the CEO of Pam Golding Properties Group, as we get into this one. Andrew, thank you so much for the time. The property market beginning to stabilize. Is that because of the economy somewhat, or is that just because there is no, you can't really go any lower than we are right now?
No, I do think that the property market has shown remarkable resilience in the face of the economic environment we find ourselves in. And we're starting to see some signs of slow improvement. So we're encouraged that we're at or near the bottom of this cycle.
In being at the bottom of the cycle, where do you see the uptick perhaps coming from? Is it purely dependent on the local economy perhaps ticking slightly higher at the very least, or would there be other factors?
Yes, I think we're not going to see a fully fledged recovery until the economy improves. So it's absolutely dependent on the economy improving, and hopefully we're going to start to see the beginning signs of some green shoots from that perspective. I think the housing market is always operates in cycles, and we certainly have been in a down cycle, and we're starting to see the beginnings of some green shoots in the housing market itself, and hopefully that twins with the economy improving, and I think then the potential for a significant upside in the housing market exists.
Mm. What are the big issues, though? I mean, the big unsustainable issues that keep ensuring that there's so many factors affecting the house prices across the country in particular, keeping them pressured at these levels outside of just economic growth. Is that really just it, or just obviously dwindling pockets for consumers, things like load shedding as well playing a part?
Yeah, there's no doubt that all of the factors, which I think everyone is so familiar with in the current South African environment, are playing a role in making sure that things stay challenged. But I think we're starting to see the banks certainly have an increased appetite for lending, and that's helping to boost the numbers and keep the resilience there. There certainly is some good numbers coming out of first-time homeowners, where 50% of mortgage advances are to first-time home buyers. And I think there is an underpinning in the first-time home buyer environment in South Africa, where increasing numbers of first-time buyers are getting into the property environment, and that augurs well for the future.
Mm. It's very easy, though, to be negative, right, about a market like this, especially when it's headed lower, the economy is down, things like load shedding keep happening, socio-political challenges keep growing, the Brexit saga weighs on, the trade war in China as well. But surely there must be, as you said, those green shoots that keep coming up, and certainly some you know, some positivity in this market. Where is the upside?
Well, I think the upside does exist in the fact that we do have a population that is that has an appetite to get into the housing market, and I think there's a lot of unfulfilled potential there. So with the economy being as sluggish as it is and the property market having shown a really remarkable resilience, when the economy does improve, I think we're going to see a rapid increase in the potential for certainly house price growth, which has obviously been in negative territory for the last 4 years. Beginning to show some capital growth for homeowners, and the start of an upcycle, which is hopefully not far away.
Yeah, would a change in interest rates change anything right now? Particularly headed, if they were headed lower, it feels like some consumers would certainly complain that it would have helped to get it a little bit lower at this stage.
Yeah, I think with inflation seemingly within the middle of the band that's best desired, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see any kind of interest rate increase for the next 12 to 18 months at least, which is obviously a positive. But to the extent that interest rates were able to be lowered, there's no doubt that that would provide a certain amount of a shot in the arm for the market, which, you know, is always a very important driver for us. The interest rates is probably the one key driver in the property market.
And mortgage advances are seemingly having outpaced house prices as well. And all of that coming through from Ramaphosa as well. But Andrew Golding, really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us on The Money Show this evening. The CEO of PAM Golding Property Group, Andrew Golding, joining us on the line there. Perhaps a stabilization in the property market and the sale then of houses. Things perhaps beginning to stabilize a little bit, and not necessarily because growth is perhaps changing course or head a little bit higher. If anything, that seemingly is going down. 0.5% growth expected for 2019, according to the finance minister, Tito Mboweni. So that tells you the saga and the situation from that front. What might just be happening is that prices are flattening out because, as you know, Andrea said, not really too many places to go to from here. For now, though, let's get into your traffic. All right, so South Africa's poultry sector has certainly been of keen interest. Remember, of course, that the United States plays a key part as well in some parts of the AGOA agreement, and chicken and poultry have been quite important in that. But this time around, the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters has welcomed the introduction of a new poultry sector master plan. This has been brokered, of course, by the Department of Trade and Industry. Even the Land Reform and Rural Development Minister, Togo Didiza, has been involved in this one, and we'll find out exactly what this master plan is about. Let's chat to Paul Matthews, the CEO then of AMIE. That's the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters. Paul, thank you so much for the time this evening. Let's chat directly about what is this master plan. What does it actually entail, and what is it that you hope will you'll be able to get out of it?
Oh, good evening, everybody. Yes, very exciting. If you take where we were at the beginning of the year to where we are now, what a change and a whole new dawn for the poultry sector within South Africa. So, yes, Mr. Patel from the Department of Trade and Industry has brought the industry together around the table to discuss how we can work together as both the importers and the local producers to ensure that we have a long-term sustainable poultry sector. So instead of having issues like we've had in the past, is rather sit around the table and see how we can move forward. So the plan itself is a framework, I think, with a lot of work that needs to be done now, but has five major pillars to it. And those pillars are to see how we can work together as imports and as a local industry to ensure that there is poultry within the country, leading right up to how do we look in the future in terms of tariffs and sort of barriers to trade, and rather discuss those and work as an industry, as a South African industry, to resolve all these issues. So very exciting, very, very positive.
Yeah. Paul, we are struggling just a little bit with your line, and hopefully it is still fine for now. You mentioned those five pillars. One of them, establishing partnerships in order to increase production. How difficult is it in an environment where trade is a massive, massive issue right now, and people are a little bit scared of where to go?
Yeah. So I think there are challenges there. That pillar really calls for the local producers to expand their own production into exports. And obviously, as AMIE, as an importer and exporter of meat, we play a critical role there to help them get a product to market. But obviously, there's a lot of work to be done from Department of Agriculture side to set up those various certificates with various countries. So that's one of probably the biggest driving point of the whole master plan.
Yeah.
But I need to emphasize and say there's a lot of work to be done there. It's going to take time to get that off the ground.
No, certainly. And unfortunately, of course, time isn't always what you have on your side, unfortunately. Paul, we are still struggling just a little bit with your line there. So what we're going to do is just take a quick break, and we're going to come back to you right after this, and hopefully we can clear up your line a little bit. We are still chatting to Paul Matthew, CEO at the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters.
702 for the curious. Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
We're still chatting then about the poultry sector in South Africa and the master plan that has promised to increase production and more jobs in South Africa's chicken industry. Talking about investment, of course, we are coming from an investment conference which ended today officially. What was it? 371 billion rand then being garnered from investors. Paul Matthew, CEO, the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters. That's the kind of element that tells you that certainly South Africa is still open for business, right? And as a part of your five key pillars is driving domestic demand and the affordability for local broiler products as well.
Yeah, correct. And I think just with ending on a very good positive note yesterday with the minister and the president as well, you can see the interest within the sector to do business. You can see the interest, obviously, with the new African trade as well, where you know, business is open. So I think the opportunities for us to work with the local sector in getting product exported to Europe or even into Africa, I think is a fantastic opportunity, both for the sector and, of course, for the country.
How best do we protect this industry, though? I mean, that's really what people would like to do, create new avenues, but certainly try to protect it and ensure that there's a sustainable growth within South Africa's poultry sector.
Yeah, I think the important thing, and also one of the pillars, is a transformation of the sector. And I think we have to have a look from both sides, the investment of investing into black farmers, small farmers, and investing in that side to ensure that we have a long-term sustainable poultry sector. But I think also what's very important, and I think going forward, is that the role that importers play. You know, we play a very important role in the sector. We've got to ensure food security in this country. I mean, a chicken is the most affordable protein for the consumer. So we play a major role in terms of ensuring that what the local producers cannot produce, we fall that side of the market. So I think it's going forward, ensuring that we invest into a really good transformation program, and how we work with the local guys in terms of both importation and obviously exportation of poultry.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the time, Paul Matthew, CEO at the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters. Good luck with the master plan as well. We'll certainly be checking in on exactly how things are going there. Thank you so much for your time. That was Paul Matthews, the CEO of the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters.
702. 702. On 92.7. And 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
It's 6 minutes after 7 o'clock, and the Money Show is proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 EMEA Finance African Banking Awards for Best Investment Bank. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Now, here's a story to be of keen interest. Capitec has continued to grow in leaps and bounds. And this time, though, they have been dealt a slight blow. They've filed for an application for leave to appeal a judgment of the Johannesburg High Court that has ordered them to give consent to a Gupta-linked company, which is looking to sell its shares in the bank, in Capitec, that is, so that that company can pay back losses that were suffered by Transnet's pension fund. Now, that order was handed down on Tuesday, and Capitec has been given 2 days to give consent to the company, which is called Coral Lagoon, an affiliate of Regiments, which then, of course, has links to the Gupta family and its associate, Salim Essa. Coral Lagoon owns around 810,230 shares. At the current value, that would give you around 1.2 billion rand when it comes to the sale of those shares. How big a deal is this? What a big blow is this for Eskom? I mean, for Capitec, should I say? And why is Capitec saying no? Why do they want to leave and appeal the decision? Kieran Ryan, who is a freelance journalist, joins us on the Ryan. Kieran, thank you so much for the time. But it's certainly one of those state capture project issues that have now fallen at the doorstep of Capitec.
That's right. The fallout from the involvement in this economy just won't stop. And this case is just one of many that's going on where companies like Eskom and Transnet Pension Fund are trying to recover monies that were stolen or allegedly stolen, should we say. Mm-hmm. What actually happened here was Regiment was appointed as the fund manager for the Transnet Pension Fund back in about 2015. Mm-hmm. And they did a deal whereby they forced the Transnet Pension Fund to purchase government bonds from itself and then sell it back to itself at a lower price, and it was pocketing the difference. Sure. And astoundingly, you know, what came out in the evidence in this court case is they made hundreds of millions over a period of literally days. You know, this would take place, I think it was over 4 days, and they made this an amount of about $325 million in a very short period of time. Sure. And, of course, the Transnet Pension Fund wants to reclaim this money because, it's one of the biggest pension funds in the country, and the pensioners are dying off at a very rapid rate. There's now about 47,000 pensioners who are tied to Transnet Pension Funds. And you go back to 2003, there were 60,000. So, clearly, something's got to be done here, and the judge very clearly went on the side of the pension fund in this case.
In going on the side of the pension fund, then, of course, Capitec said, look, we understand this, but unfortunately, they're going to take a leave of appeal for this decision. How much hurt does this bring to a company like Capitec? Because share price is well over, 1,400 Rand right now, odd. The selling of 810,000 shares could certainly hurt.
Well, it will hurt. And in fact, in Capitec's defense, what they have said and what they did say in their papers that they would permit the what they called an open offer. They were going to allow Coral Lagoon to sell about 400,000 shares at the current market price. As you say, it's about 14 Rand 20 at the moment. That would give them an amount of about 590 million, more than enough to cover the claim. So what Transnet is claiming back, what the settlement is 500 million. But the judge didn't buy that. I'll tell you where the hurt is. First of all, the Capitec is going to have to replace the Black Empowered shareholder. If Coral Lagoon goes, now they represent about 1.1% of the total Capitec shareholding. That would have to be replaced. Is that going to be a stretch? It's difficult to tell. I think Capitec is saying it is. The judge didn't seem to think it was that much of a stretch for them to do that. But I'll tell you where I think the hurt is. In another sense, the judgment is quite damning. It's damning against Capitec and the way that they conducted themselves in this case, and it's damning against the chairman, Santi Botha, because of the way that email correspondence seemed to imply that they were amenable to a settlement with the pension fund, and then they changed course at various times during negotiations. So the judge used terms like lack of good faith or bad faith, this kind of thing. You don't really want that sitting on your record as a reputable bank like Capitec.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And the bank did not say on what grounds that they had filed the application for leave to appeal the decision, though. But that's kind of obvious, as kind of to say exactly what the reasoning behind this is. But as you've said a little bit earlier, the affiliation then with the Gupta families has certainly continued to hurt South Africa's economy. And here's another step for a company that was perhaps faring along very well.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, if the Guptas were ever to step into this country again, I think they'd be rounded up and locked up, without any wasting of time whatsoever, because we're only now beginning to see the ramifications of their plunder in this country. And really, when you look at who's suffering here, you've got tens of thousands of pensioners at Transnet. This is just one example, never mind what happened at Eskom and elsewhere. And I got an email today from a pensioner who belongs to the Transnet Pension Fund saying that he's 84 years old. He worked his entire life at Transnet, dutifully served the company and the country. And what is he getting? He's getting around 4,000 Rand per month. which is escalating at the rate of 2% a year. So he's actually going backwards. How, you know, these pensioners are surviving. Wow. And I believe that's the case with about 80% of them. They really are having a tough time.
Good grief. And
that's one of the consequences here.
Yeah, and Capitec here is just looking to perhaps, you know, avoid or try to protect, rather, its triple BEE status, of course, because Regiments, the Regiments affiliate, that's Coral Lagoon, is, of course, black-owned as well. So that could be another factor here.
Yes, I mean, Capitec is saying that they do have concern for the Transnet pensioners. However, those are words, and they may be empty words. The real gesture here is like, you know, well, let's do the right thing for the pensioners and get them this money. Allow this share sale to go through so that the pension fund can top up. They are saying that they don't want the benefits of this or the proceeds of this sale to benefit people who were involved in state capture. But now this evidence was also aired in court where the individuals at Coral Lagoon were not part of that. They were not involved in the state capture project as far as we know. Mm. And that's in the judgment as well. So I don't know if that argument from Capitec holds any water.
Sure. Certainly going to be an interesting one, and interesting to see how it fares in the courts as well, whether they are granted that leave to appeal the judgment of the Johannesburg High Court, which has ordered it to give consent to a Gupta-linked company selling its shares in Capitec in order to pay back losses suffered by a Transnet pension fund. Those losses valued at around 500 million rand there. So that is how much that needs to be paid back in hopes of you know, retribution, I suppose, in this deal. Kieran Ryan, thank you so much for the time. Freelance journalist, they're joining us and helping us unpack that Capitec story. A slightly complicated one, but I think certainly siding in the favor of the pension fund would certainly go a long way.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
All right, on Thursdays, of course, we have our personal finance feature. And this time around, we're chatting again to Warren Ingram, personal finance advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital. Why you should ignore your conventional advice before retirement. Go on then and be a little risky, be a little more less wary, shall we say, before headed into retirement. That's what you're telling people, Warren.
I am.
Why? Yeah. I mean, all this time, we've known that if you're getting closer to retirement, just be a little bit more conservative, just so that you make sure you have that money in the bank anyway.
And I think, you know, if we were dying the same way we used to die 30 years ago. In other words, at the we were only living for another 4 or 5 years after retirement,
sure,
and then we would pass away. Then that would be great advice. De-risk your portfolio. You know, go more into cash, more into government bonds, less into shares. Protect what you've got because you need to live off the capital and generate as much income as you can. And so, you know, leave behind what you can to your beneficiaries, but you're fine. The problem now is, not problem, I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing, but the it creates a financial problem, is we're not dying at age, you know, 70, we're dying at 85, and every
and
time
beyond.
And exactly now, and every time I meet 85-year-olds, I'm surprised at how sprightly they look, and yeah. I know they're going for another 5 or 10 years. and so for them, if they had followed that advice, which is and this is not just aimed at financial advisors. This is big pension funds. I mean, I remember one of the big banks until about 5 years ago, they would force their employees to take their portfolios, and let's just say, you know, a typical retirement fund is allowed up to 75% of the capital to be invested in shares. That's what the law allows.
Yeah.
And most pension funds over long periods of time, they would run with about 65 to 75% in shares. Sure. Typical portfolio. But what happens with the retirees that are, let's say, 5 years and closer to retirement, is that these big funds would say, hang on, we're going to move you into more and more and more cash and less and less risk. So that, let's just say, your retirement fund is $2 million and it's 5 years from retirement. We know that it's going to be really close to $2 million by the time you do retire, and you're not going to have taken the loss. And intuitively, that makes sense, right? I mean, I don't want to lose what I've got.
So I'm definitely going to get something. It may not be more than I could have earned somewhere else, but at least I have something. That was, I guess, the sentiment, right?
Yeah, and on the face of it, not bad. I get the kind of the high level advice, but the problem with that is that if you're going to live for another 25 or 30 years, and you're running with a very high balance in cash, and let's say government bonds are okay, but a very small allocation in shares, the difficulty you've got is that if you've got less than 35% of your retirement fund in shares, then you're not going to beat inflation with your money. So sure. So for the first few years, let's say, you know, going up to the point of retirement, and then the first few years thereafter, you're going to feel like a hero because every month your money's gone up a little bit because it's been earning some interest and everything's great. And especially over the last 3 or 4 years, you're going to be looking at all your mates who've got their money in shares and they've gone nowhere, right?
We all know that much.
And so you're going to feel great. But the problem is that cash doesn't beat inflation over a very long period of time. So what happens then is that slowly but surely the buying power of your money gets less and less and less. And then eventually you wake up not one day, but you wake up over time. It becomes this gradual, horrible realization that actually my money can't buy what it used to. And by the time that really lands, that message really lands and the realization is there, you don't have enough money anymore to take more risk. You cannot afford to take the risk anymore, and you cannot afford to buy what you used to buy.
So how aggressive are you suggesting we go here, especially in the latter parts of, headed towards retirement?
My view is that, the retirement fund regulation, so it's this wonderful thing called Regulation 28. Regulation 28 says 75% in shares is the maximum that any retirement fund can have. I think that's a great number. I think that it's
so all the way through to the day you retire, 266, you're saying suggestively go all the way into shares up until that date.
Stay with that balance because the other part of that money is sitting in cash and in government bonds and then potentially property companies as well.
Yeah.
And so that mix over a very long period of time would probably give you roundabout, and I'm not saying there's no guarantees in life, but it'll probably give you roundabout 10 or 11% growth per year. And if we look at inflation at 6, then you're in a position where you're saying, okay, so I can draw 4 or 5% of my money every year on a sustainable basis, and I'm allowing inflation at 6 to keep being reinvested. That, so if you're getting 11%, you're drawing 5, that's 6% left over, you reinvest that. And so your money doesn't go backwards in buying power. And what it means then is that you give your capital the best chance to grow over a 25 or 30 year period. And so you maintain the buying power of your money. Yes, there are risks. And the last 5 years would have been a great example of why that wasn't a great idea.
Sure.
But what's going to happen now, and if we look at what the market's done over the last while, you probably track it better than I do, but I mean, the market's been kind to us in the last few days, and the cash investor has lost out on that and potentially whatever may come in the future.
Just the one-month basis is more than 4% already. The three-month has gone up around 3% as well. And yet, you know, on the year, we've actually gone up around 7%. Yet, at some point, it looked absolutely dire.
And that's the trick with this whole thing, is we wouldn't have sat here at the beginning of January and said, wow, you know, we expect the market to go up 7%. Yeah. We wouldn't have. There are no good reasons why, when you look at the economic news and you listen to our finance minister talk about 0.5% GDP growth, and you know, I mean, I'm furious with the unions because I think they're doing their best to keep our growth constrained. And so why would the market go up? There wouldn't have been the bell that was rung to say, hey, now's the time to get in the market. Sure. This is the year. Yeah. This is the recovery. And now we're talking to retirees who are sitting in cash, feeling okay, but they've missed out on this.
Sure.
And the problem is that they might miss out on the next 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, let's say, where they get another 6 or 7%. And that jump that markets give us, suddenly they're not going to participate. So what will happen is they're probably not listening to us now because they're saying, that guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I've made my 7% a year. And so 5 or 10 years from now, their buying power is eroded. Mm. And so to go back to that 75%, I think that it's actually a good call. I think it's something that you want to maintain. The reason you don't do that, the reason why you might not do that, is if you said, I know my health's really bad.
Yeah.
I know I've got, you know, I've got some serious illnesses, et cetera, and I just don't think, my lifespan is 25 years to go. It might be 3 or 5 years looking at the medical conditions of my own body. Then that might be a reason why you would say, hang on, okay, so de-risk the portfolio a lot more. Don't have so much in shares.
Yeah.
Because that makes a lot of sense to me. And then the last category of investor that shouldn't have a lot in shares, I think, would be those who are already in financial trouble. They hit retirement and they know that they can't sustain themselves on drawing 5% a year.
Yeah.
And I think that it sounds crazy, but when you don't have enough money already at retirement, you actually can't afford to take more risk. So you've got to take the least amount of risk possible because you're going to be drawing such a big percentage from your retirement. So those are investors as well who I would say, okay, hang on, de-risk your portfolio. But if you've got just enough or a little bit more than enough and you've done your planning and you're okay, don't have too little in shares.
So finding the right mix for your scenario and for your situation is as you say, absolutely key then in a situation like this. The how long you maintain that though, as you said, in terms of being risky, for example, and keeping it at 75% just in equities, keeping it there for longer, that changes just how much you have at the end of that retirement span. And as you said, because we're living for another 20, 25 years odd, if not more, after retirement, the question becomes, you've noted out who shouldn't, but how do you know for yourself whether you should be staying or whether you're comfortable enough to perhaps no longer stay at 75% in equities? And for example, as we said, the last 3, 4, 5 years haven't been the greatest when it comes to equity and that space. You may have wanted to change your mix right now because you're getting close to retirement.
And that would be a terrible idea. So that's the classic market timing. So someone, if you're saying, I'm 2 years from retirement, I've seen what the JSE hasn't done.
Mm.
I'm going to de-risk my portfolio, if that's the question.
Sure, yes.
Then my suggestion is please don't do that, because what's going to happen now is you've ridden the ride nowhere, which is really where the JSE's gone.
Yes.
We've been on the road to nowhere. But potentially, it's far too early to call it, but potentially we're finding direction, and the direction is at least looking up at the moment. And if you cash in now, you reduce the share exposure that you've got. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that the results that we've seen from companies like Clicks and Pick and Pay and the like, and more of them, Altron, all of those companies that are starting to deliver good results. What you're saying is those are the last sets of good results that we're going to hear. We're not going to hear anymore. The banks in South Africa that have adjusted their cost base, all of those things, that's not going to deliver any fruits to investors. And I think that's a bad call to make. So
sure.
my view would be stay invested because I think if we look at the South African businesses here, the ones that are still around, they have adjusted themselves to the current environment. This is Darwin at work, right? The fittest are surviving.
Indeed.
And when times are good, watch them turn and watch them deliver results. And you've got to be invested to get that benefit of the last 5 years that you haven't.
To win it, right?
Pretty much.
Warren, thank you so much for the time. Ignore the conventional advice. Get more risky. Enjoy the risk and hopefully it'll pay off in the end. That's the certain hope and advice then from personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital, Warren Ingram on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you relevant market insights through the Africa Financial Markets Index Report. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show. Small business.
It's 24 minutes to 8 o'clock as we get to chat to Pablo Fetidis. Well, this small business focus is brought to you by PwC. PwC helps private companies build, grow, and evolve their business through the tough times and the good times. Pablo, trying to create an asset, trying to build an asset in the tough times and in the difficult times is a whole lot worse or a whole lot more difficult than in the good times, surely?
No, it's not at all.
Really? The other way around?
No. When I walked in here, I said, how are you? And you said to me,
complaining doesn't help.
Complaining doesn't help. And I'm saying, please, everybody out there, complain. Complain
not to me,
loudly.
Not to me, but to
complain
you.
Complain to the world, because in a complaint, it means something's not working for that person. And if something's not working for that person,
sure,
and you have an entrepreneurial mindset, it's an opportunity to fix what's not working and hopefully do so for sale and for value.
Fair enough. So now we're trying to build assets.
Yeah, well, the big question that should be asked is, what are you doing and why are you doing it? If you're in business, what are you doing and why are you doing it?
Trying to make money.
Yeah, but okay, make money. Honestly, make money is not that hard. Sustain making money is hard.
Okay.
Making money turn into wealth is incredibly hard.
Sure.
Unless you have a system and an approach and you know very clearly why you're doing what you're doing. Because think of it, I can find something today, trade it with you today. You give me money for it, I use some of that money tomorrow to buy another thing, trade it again.
Yeah.
It doesn't really achieve anything. It feels like you're constantly chasing your tail. And it's got nothing to do with being an on-the-side street trader. It's got everything to do with how you build the business and how you see yourself and how you see what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
I see businesses that are doing 50, 60, 70 million rand a year, and all they're doing is simply trading day in and day out and day in and day out.
Sure. An asset of value, though.
What you should be doing, what and that
is,
alone.
What is that? I mean, aren't all assets value?
No, not at all. So look, I found a definition for the word asset, and I wanted to be very technical with this definition.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to read it to you. Okay, where is it? Right. So it says over here, an asset is something that has value. It contains value. It says, an asset is anything of value or a resource of value that represents economic potential. So, for example, a bar of gold.
Sure.
A trading asset, trading is an ability to buy or sell something. So, for example, a share on the stock exchange. You can buy it and you can trade it if it's got liquidity.
Sure.
So I think that the single focus of every business owner out there is to build an asset of value, and that is a tradable asset. It means a business that you can buy or a business that you can sell for good economic value.
And I suppose, as you said, that's the whole point of being in business, right? To try and not just create or make the money, but really develop the reason for having that business, create that asset of value. The question some people may ask themselves eventually is why? Why should I build this asset of value? Or can't I just make the cash for me and become rich essentially, or hopefully anyway?
Yeah, cash doesn't make you rich. No, cash doesn't make you rich. You know, there's a big difference between making money and creating wealth.
Mm, 100%.
And a lot of people look at the word wealth and associate it to, and I'm not talking about wealth through health and wealth through happiness and all that type of stuff. Yeah. I'm talking about financial wealth.
Mm.
The ability to have accumulated resources that give you the power to make things happen.
Yeah.
I'm talking about that kind of wealth. And if we look at, let's say, enormous assets out there, used to be Anglo-American, no more. I mean, it's basically dissolved itself out of South Africa. It has a few assets left, but it's moved on.
Mm.
When you look at the big names out there, Johnson & Johnson, but also in trouble today.
Sure.
When you look at the big names out there, it's often that when you look back in the history, they started 4, 5, 6, 7 generations ago.
Yeah.
It takes time to get to that level of significance and size where you have a balance sheet that contains the equity value of that business. So that of a day, should you wish to, you can translate all of that into the cash through an effective sale. And Rebile, my big issue is it is hard to build a business. It takes untold amounts of sweat and sacrifice.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, when you run your own business, you pay yourself last. You constantly are left on this journey alone.
Mm.
You make enormous sacrifices to your health, to your well-being, to your family. I think of the early days when I started, my youth was literally robbed by the demands of the business that I had bought.
Sure.
It takes an enormous sacrifice. And yes, you can make some money during that period. But the real liquidity moment, the first liquidity moment that sets you apart from a wealth perspective is when you get to a point where you can exit that business for a capital profit. Not for the money that you've made and the salaries you've earned and the cash you've generated over the period. But it's where you sell the business at a point in time. Someone comes along and says, I want to take it to the next level. I'm going to pay you for what you've done, and I'm going to pay you for some of its latent potential that you've locked into this business. And in that, I'm going to pay you a sum of money that should be of far higher value and tax gain and benefit to everything you've earned up to that point in time.
We're not patient enough for it, though, for that process. Would you find that that's sometimes the case with some entrepreneurs? We're not willing to wait out the course,
Time. Good luck. Then you weren't born to do it.
Yeah.
Then good luck to you. Chase your tail for your whole life. Call yourself a serial entrepreneur where you start a whole lot of things, you finish nothing, and achieve absolutely nothing. Leave no impact, achieve very little, make some money, put some food on the table. That's a choice. I don't believe in that. And I've never seen it reward successfully, sufficiently, and in the long term.
Yeah, sustainably either. All right, Pavlo, we're going to go to a quick break for now. And when we come back, we're going to go through your six steps, right? Your six building blocks to building an asset of value. And we'll get to unpack all of those right after this.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you relevant market insights through the Africa Financial Markets Index Report. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show. Small business.
Well, we continue with our small business focus, and Pavlo Fotidis, founder at Auric Business Accelerator, still joining us here in studio. And this time around, we're talking about building an asset of value and why it's critical to do so. In trying to build these assets of value, then a lot of people will tell you that they've hustled their way into this industry or whatever industry they're in, and they keep on hustling and they keep on fighting away and finding ways to make money. Are you finding that the word hustle is overused?
Yeah, I think the word hustle's been made to be sexy, and it's been made to sound cool. Mm. But let me tell you, hustling is not fun. It is not fun.
Yeah,
it's not fun. It's absolutely critical to sweat it out and hustle in the beginning. But if you're still hustling after 3 years, after 5 years, after 7 years, then surely it means one of two things. It means that there's nothing there and you have wishful dreams that aren't going to yield anything. Mm. And at some point in time, everyone has to turn around and say, this path I've chosen is not working for me. I've got to have the courage to change and find a different path. Or alternatively, what it means is you don't have a proper method to turn the hustle into a business that can be built into an asset.
Yeah.
And that's often the case, more often than not. So understanding what the end game is behind a hustle, rather than just saying, well, I need to make a dollar today and then sell it and turn it tomorrow. If you adopt that mindset, then you will never build anything. You will simply keep yourself busy. Mm. And being busy doesn't create anything. It doesn't build anything. If you say, I'm going to turn a dollar today with a view to make it $2 tomorrow and turn $2 into $4 the following day, and you have a structure and a path to do that, you should start getting out of the hustle and into the building. And when you build, that's when you have the opportunity to create that asset.
Yeah. So you make note of six building blocks then in order to build an asset of value. Let's get into these. The first one, positioning.
Yeah, they're all stuck on top of each other, right? And it all begins with positioning. And what positioning is, it's the way that you are seen to be special in the eyes of your customer. So not your mom or dad who loves you.
Yeah.
Not your spouse who loves you. Not your friends who are going to back you and say, Aribila, this thing you're doing is going to rock and roll. It's going to knock the lights out. Keep on at it, buddy. Good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Now can we talk about the rugby or the soccer or whatever it might be?
Mm.
You know, they want to move on from the conversation as fast as possible. Positioning is about what makes you special in the eyes of your customer. And there are only two things that can achieve that. The first thing is, if what you're doing does not solve a problem for your customer, they won't buy from you. I promise you. There's no such thing as a luxury in life. Everyone spends money to have a problem solved. Sometimes they're not aware of it, but you need to be aware of what problem you solve for them. The second thing it needs to do, the experience that they have in dealing with you needs to be a great experience. There's nothing worse than thinking you're going to get a problem solved and you invite the plumber into your home and they fix the broken geyser, problem solved, and as they leave, their muddy paw prints on the wall and the stepladder broke the window pane and the door got smacked and jammed. So it's a problem solved through the right kind of experience.
Mm.
Getting that right is where the hustle comes into play. It's the hardest thing to get right. But if you don't have that right, then the foundation of what you're going to build above it won't work.
Momentum then as well. So you've positioned yourself now sufficiently. I need the momentum to continue.
Yeah, well, now you know what you do and why you do it and why it matters. You've got your purpose. You've got your positioning. Now you've got to build a sales momentum. You've got to get the money coming in. That means you've got to find customers. You've got to reach those customers when they show an interest in what you have to offer through the experience you've created for them. You've got to get them converting from inquiries into customers. And here's the thing. It needs to be done in a manner, and you need to build a business that does this eventually without you. And on top of it, it needs to happen 365 days of the year. Because the last thing you want is a business that generates revenues for you for, okay, not 12 months of the year because December's a holiday. In fact, not 11 months of the year because April's a holiday. And in fact, not 10 months of the year because August is kind of a holiday too. When you have 12 months of expenses, you want 12 months of revenues coming in. Yeah. If you don't create a selling system, something that finds customers, gets them excited, and converts them from inquiries into transactions, you don't have momentum.
So that positioning and this momentum, is that what we characterize as the hustle?
Yeah, in part it is. It's more positioning that is around the hustle.
Yeah.
Momentum is where you're starting to do the build. It's where you've understood what problem you solve for who, what experience you need to give them. Momentum is the early stages of building the activities that are independent of you, that you can train someone to do on your behalf in the business to generate the leads and convert the leads and bring customers in.
Yeah. At some point then you have to find fulfillment.
Yeah. Well, now you've signed the deal. You've got a customer. You have to deliver.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, Aribile, if you don't deliver on their expectation that you created in the momentum stage based on your understanding of how you position, well, you're going to have very grumpy people. And grumpy people are not good for business. In fact, my argument is, where is a brand built? A brand isn't built by fancy advertising and big billboards and TV ads. It's not built there. It's not built by a whole lot of events and activities of that nature. A brand is built when somebody becomes a customer and their expectations are met
fully, yeah,
on the basis of why they became a customer. Operations is critical. There is nothing more terrifying when you build a business and you've made promises and then you don't have the ability to deliver against that promise. Mm. So that process of fulfillment is where you build organized operations that make sure you've got great people on board who are really focused on getting the product out, getting the service out, and meeting that expectation that you created in the momentum stage based on your positioning.
Mm. Sure. Okay. Then another one is to give yourself time.
Yeah. Well, think about it this way. If you get those three elements right, those first three building blocks right, and you've got the right team doing the right thing at the right time, it releases your time. And what should your time be doing? I often say to people, do you have time to think? Think about what? Think about three things that will triple your business in the next year or two. And very often, what I hear coming back to me is very poorly thought through and articulated. And it's not because they don't know. And it's not because they're smart. And it's not because they don't want it. It's because their mind is so cluttered with the day-to-day operational activities and fulfillment and momentum. And they don't have the time to think, because it does take time to think. You're the most expensive resource in your business. You take the biggest risks. Yeah. If you're not driving the growth way beyond your organic month-to-month, year-to-year growth, well, then you will achieve nothing more than organic year-to-year, month-to-month growth. Sure. And time runs out. So you have to make sure that you are investing time in the right things, not spending it doing the engine work.
Yeah, because you can't be spending it, as we said a little bit earlier, just continuously hustling.
Yep, you
because
can't.
You've really laid yourself a little too thin, and you haven't clearly gotten all the positioning right to begin with then.
Completely. And what have you actually achieved at the end of the day? So you made a dollar, but you haven't created a system that makes the dollar for you.
Yeah, yeah. And the aim is to try and make that dollar without you doing the heavy lifting anymore.
Completely.
Right.
You should be thinking how to make $5 when the engine makes the dollar on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. So one of the ones that all small businesses cry about and completely always ask the question and say to themselves, I never have enough funding.
Yeah, well, you know, funding isn't the answer to everything. In fact, funding can be enormously full of pain, heartache, and headache if it's not done right. This idea that you can build a business plan and on Excel you're a billionaire because you've run your numbers and it looks good. Using that to raise funding so someone can give you 5 million rand, 1 million rand, whatever the case is, to start your business, I think people need to just, here's some really free, very, very free, enormously valuable advice. Mm. It doesn't happen. So don't do it. That's not how you raise funding. You first have to generate those three layers underneath you. Not at an enormous scale, not at an enormous level. But why would you fund me in my business if I didn't know what I stood for, if I had no positioning, if I didn't demonstrate that I can create momentum, if I didn't demonstrate that I can fulfill on the promise of the momentum, and more importantly, if I don't have time to spend with you so that I can actually explain what I do, take advice from you, and talk in depth about how the funding would be applied. And yet, at the same time, if you don't have a line of funding, you will never, ever grow beyond your organic growth rates. So if you do have time and you can think of the three things that will triple the size of your business in a year, believe you me, you need a good line of funding. And more importantly, you need it from someone who will have a good chemistry with you, understand your business, be excited about it, and know that tripling the size of the business in the next year will probably only happen in the next 3 years.
Yeah, sure. And take your time about it, I suppose. As you said, focus on growth. Think, give yourself the time to continuously think. The last one then of your six building blocks to building an asset of value is to sell.
Yeah, well, an asset, remember, needs to have value and be tradable. And if you come to that,
this is not necessarily selling your business off, right?
No, it's not necessarily selling the business in its entirety.
Yeah.
But you never know. You know, circumstances change. Some people are choosing to live in different places. Some people might suffer a change of sentiment or heart. There could be a tragedy in the family. Mm. Someone falls ill. You always want to be in a position where the effort that you are applying into building a business puts that business in a position where it's constantly sellable, so that should someone of a day knock on the door and say, Aribile, I really like what you do. I'm looking to buy. And they put some money on the table that is exciting for you and you decide to sell it. You need to be sure that the deal will happen. And here's the thing. Are you as an individual for sale? Because if you're not, and you have not built that business separate from yourself, in other words, you've not created it as an asset that's tradable, that opportunity will be lost.
Mm. For some people who may think that, you know, the business itself is very dependent on them being there because that's the model of the business. How do you work around something?
No, like that's not the model of the business. That's the model that you have built. When you create an asset of value, the model of the business, irrespective as to what industry or sector you're in, will be such that the value lies in the business. It doesn't lie in you, and it doesn't lie in your hands, and it doesn't lie in your time.
Mm. Pavlo Fatidis, thank you so much for the time. Every business owner should be building at least just one thing, and that is an asset of value. Pavlo Fatidis joining us, of course, as the founder at Auric Business Accelerator and our Small Business Focus this Thursday evening, getting to grips then with building an asset of value.